Okay, thank you. Okay, as I said, it will be about strong field control in molecules. And before I don't have the time in the end, I acknowledge especially the collaborators on this project, which is Erich Goll and Günther Wunder. Erich is in Tübingen, but now he's changed to be a teacher, and Günther is at the University of Stuttgart, and of course my group and the financial resources. Now, the motivation, I will just have some very short motivation for why we are doing this or how we came about. And the motivation in this field is watching intramolecular motion or chemical reactions in real time. And we have also a group working on ultra-cold atoms, but here this will be, as I said, the strong field project. I will shortly, because I think it's a rather diverse auditory, discuss molecular ionization in tense long-wave laser fields. Then I will come to the main process, which is watching nuclear motion via a process which we called Lochfraß, which is a German word for eating a hole, but it's more violently because it is animals eating. Yeah, I mean, of course, hole eating, hole carving, etc., has all been given away already before us, so we had to find something new, and we thought it is really the violent processes I will discuss. I will shortly, maybe if I have the time, point out that this can be even used to watch quantum tunneling in real time. I mean, this is rather fancy in the strong field community, although I have a lot of caveats about that and my personal opinion. And then I will try to discuss what we lately have been trying to find out, how to come from Lochfraß to what we would like to call coherence distillation. And just to have it once, that to show that I actually know how a molecule and a molecular reaction looks like, even if we are rather far away from analyzing one. But here I was really involved with chemists to really find out the chemical reaction mechanism of a pretty complicated catalytic reaction. Of course, they did all the chemistry. I did only help them with the kinetics and the analysis. Okay. The key point is that in this study where we figured out the whole reaction mechanism, this was a very slow thing. This was done with NMR technique, but a very clever idea of Gerrit Lundstra. But the key point is we could even get the thermodynamics. But what we could not get and cannot get is what happens really here. So how does the system come from here to here, even if we know about the energetics and the kinetics to the barrier height, but we don't know really how it comes over from this side or the other. So this is really the motivation in the moment in the strong field area to try to get a molecular movie, try to see how a molecule or a molecular complex goes from one side to the other, and really what happens here, and is this a single state, or is this a whole surface which is probed by tunneling, etc. So this is the motivation. As I said, we are far away from that. Now, how do we do it with strong field physics? So how do we combine watching reactions with strong field physics? Now, this is a very simple qualitative pictures of strong field physics, just to give you an idea where we will be later on. So the standard processes you should know, of course, is you have one photon ionization, or if you need more than one photon to overcome the ionization threshold, and there's a resonance state in between, you can have resonance enhanced multiphoton ionization, or you have without the resonant intermediate state just multiphoton ionization, you absorb more photons sufficiently that you get into the continuum, or even you absorb more photons than you need to come into the continuum, which is called above threshold ionization. This is the terminology. So this is one so-called photon picture or multiphoton picture, with a big caveat that there are no photons here, because we treat everything semi-classical in intense laser fields, because statistics of the photons doesn't play a role in these extreme intensities. Whether you absorb even 100 photons, the statistics will not change of the laser field. So it's really an electric field, or maybe a magnetic field. So it's a semi-classical treatment. So the name multiphoton is a little bit misleading. However, we will not go into this regime. But we think, or we try to describe the processes here in the so-called quasi-static regime. And here the idea is that your frequency of the electric field change in the laser field is sufficiently slow, of course, in relation of your system, that the system sees it, so to speak, as a quasi-static electric field which slowly changes in time. In the extreme case, it will be adiabatically following and ionizing at any instant of time as it would see an electric field with this strength. So in this case, what happens is you add to the Coulomb potential, you add the electric field, and then your electron can tunnel out through the barrier, or it may even overcome the barrier if the strength of the field is sufficiently high. So these two pictures are very successfully used, and typically people speak, even more simplifying and more incorrectly sometimes, of the tunneling regime here, yeah, where typically the imaging is done in the strong field area, not like an X-ray, of course, where you are more in the multiphoton regime. Okay, so just to give you an idea where we are in the parameter space, if this is a photon energy divided by the ionization potential or binding energy of your system, yeah, so then you have this arrow of increasing photon energy, and here you have the field strength, the electric field strength, the maximum in the laser pulse, also given in some relative to the binding energy of your electron or the ionization potential. And then you have, so to speak, if you have a strong field and a low frequency, you are in this quasi-static regime. If you are in the high frequency, low intensity regime, you are in the multiphoton picture, and here's the validity of the lowest order perturbation theory. And here, as I said, the tunneling and the over the barrier regimes distinguishing these two quasi-static or adiabatic regimes. So this is just to tell you where we are in this abstract parameter space. Okay? So as I said, we will concentrate on this part of the diagram. So in this part, as I said, it's a quasi-static approximation. You say that your ionization rate in an AC field, in the electromagnetic field, which you describe as a time-varying electric field, is given by the static ionization rate in a static DC field as a function of a time-varying field strength. Yeah? That's the simplest approximation in this regime, which you normally do. So it's a low frequency, high intensity regime, as I said. This formulation implies length gauge. This is one of the funny aspects of this. If you go into the velocity gauge, your tunneling picture is gone. Yeah, that's very surprising and confusing, but it's just pictures, yeah, I remind you. Now, even if you make this rough approximation, you still need the DC ionization rates for your system, which is actually not trivial beyond hydrogen atom. And the first full solution for H2, actually, I did more than 10 years ago. But nevertheless, it was rather late that this has been succeeded, and I used complex scaling to achieve that. I will come to this because we will need these results as a comparison. Now, a further simplification of doing a full ab initio calculation, as I said, which will be difficult in a strong static field even, is to use the so-called tunneling models. They have some acronyms, as usual, Amosov, Dilov, and Krainov, or Perelmanov, Popov, Terentov. This doesn't really matter. You can find also the simplest formula in Landau, as it should be. And so the ionization rate basically is proportional to the exponential function of the binding energy or ionization potential divided by the field strength. And that's the minus, of course. And that's the basic behavior in this tunneling regime. Yeah? So this is really very simple. And that gives you, however, a number of insights of qualitative and principal ideas of how the physics will be. In over the barrier ionization, there's even simpler formulas because there this formula doesn't work. There are some modifications, but it's not really so convincing like this formula in its validity regime. So the nice thing with this regime is that you can use it for imaging. And the reason is that, as I said, you have this simple tunneling relation. So it just depends on the field strength and the binding energy of your electron. And this has the advantage. Actually, there's another advantage I forgot now to put here on this overhead. One thing is, of course, it tells you that the valence electron, the highest lying electron with the smallest binding energy, will ionize very dominantly, And every lower lying electron will be exponentially suppressed. And this gave the hope in the beginning that you are really sensitive to the outermost, the chemically most relevant electrons. Yeah, in the meantime, we know that due to symmetry, also other orbitals can come into play. But in first order, it's the highest lying orbital which is ionizing most strongly. The second thing is, if you believe in this, this means that your ionization will only occur at the field maxima of one laser cycle, so in the upper and lower end of the cycle, even in a linear polarized laser field, which means that you have effectively a sub-laser cycle time resolution, if you can make out something of the image or the response you get. So this is why this area has been pushed a little bit into the direction of watching, doing time resolution studies. Now, if you go to molecules, the big question is there a nuclear geometry dependence of tunnel ionization? This question for a molecular physicist sounds very strange. Actually, when the field came from atomic physics and laser development in the 90s, it was clearly said no. Yeah, you just have the mining energy to take into account, so you plug in a number and you get your ion yield. So there's no molecular effect in that sense. This was a little bit surprising. Yeah, sorry?
On the previous slide, F was dependent on time, right?
Yes, it's the same here.
So it depends on time.
Exactly, this is why you get this sub-laser cycle time resolution. Yeah. So you add it only at the maxima of your laser field, in a linear polarized laser field. Okay, I hope this is somehow readable. Now, thinking about a molecule from a molecular physicist's perspective, it's not just an atom. Okay, this seems to be trivial, but as I said, in this community it was not really appreciated. So taking a diatomic molecule as an example, you can consider three generic cases. One case is like a nitrogen, where basically a chemist would say you remove a non-binding electron, and as a consequence, your ionic potential curve will look very similar and at the same position, be at the same position as your neutral one. As a consequence, it will behave like an atom. The binding energy as a function of internuclear separation will have no effect or no variation. However, if you have a system like oxygen and you remove an antibonding electron in the chemist's language, this means your bond going to the ion will be shortened. Therefore, you have a shift of your potential curve. And as a consequence of this exponential behavior, and if you assume that you do an extension, which I proposed at that time, to replace the ionization potential by the real difference of the binding energy, but now in the Born-Oppenheimer spirit, between the neutral and the ion, as a function of the internuclear separation R, then you will find that this difference, of course, exponentially blown up in this ionization yield, will give an ionization yield which will have a very strong dependence on the internuclear separation. And this is a logarithmic scale from 10 to the minus 7 to 1. The same happens for H2, but in the opposite direction. You remove a bonding electron, the bond length will stretch, and as a consequence, you will have, again, this mismatch, and the difference will be non-constant, and as a consequence of this exponential thing, you will have a very strong R-dependent ion yield. Actually, I put it as a kind of natural conclusion, but I didn't realize that I really got a lot of trouble with this statement, that there should be no Frank-Condon distribution for molecules like H2 and oxygen, because all simulations done to that time were assuming the Frank-Condon approximation. Yeah? Assuming that this will be even more violent, the electron will be driven even more violent than in one photon ionization, so there can be no R dependence. So it should be Frank-Condon. Okay? Now, I did a full calculation, as I said, of an initial calculation in a complex scaling, and this, the basic idea is that this extended ADK rate is the blue one, and in the around the equilibrium distance of H2, it fits extremely well with a full ab initio calculation, fully correlated, full dimensional. Yeah, it was a little bit, if this wouldn't be here, this was very disappointing. I mean, you do the full strength calculation and what you get out is 80K. Yeah, not really good. But of course, it was nice to see that you have this strong R dependence. And this was, of course, the basic message I want to transform here. Now, yes, sorry.
On that graph, what does it mean if you start from a H2 ground state molecule, what does it mean to have this dependence up to 8 atomic units?
Okay, that's a good question. Of course, physically, you will, first of all, in the equilibrium, you will only probe this area. So you will just see this. However, if you would make the molecule dissociating, you should see this maximum here. But we will not concentrate on this maximum here, so you can forget about it for this talk. Yeah? And actually, it's very difficult and has not been seen yet because of this problem. You're completely right. So we are concentrating on this regime here. Okay, now there was a nice, however very difficult to read the thing, so with the collaboration with an experimental group which really managed to measure the H2 plus distribution and confirmed the non-Frank quantum distribution in very good agreement with the simple model I had. It was a very clever experiment to directly measure the H2 plus vibration distribution produced in H2. So just to say that the theory seems to be fine, then I have to mention here that there is another effect, which I predicted here, which had been known for the molecular cations long ago, actually in the 60s, 70s predicted, but there at the same paper it was predicted not to occur in H2 neutral. And it occurs for a different reason, and what happens is the following, that you have here the potential curve, the ground state potential curve, in the field, in a static field, will not be like the field-free one going like this, but it will make this turn down. And you see also that the bond will be weakened. This is called bond softening because of this molecular cation effect. And the motivation here is, however, is different than in the molecular cation. The reason is the following, that you have a crossing between the H plus H minus state, which in the field would go linearly down, yeah, normally lies very high up and doesn't exist in an adiabatic calculation, actually. Yeah, it's only existing in the diabatic picture. And this ionic curve crosses, makes an avoided crossing with a neutral dissociation limit H1s and H1s. And as a consequence, you get a crossover from the neutral to the ionic dissociation in the field. But for us, again, this is a high separation. We are mainly interested in this talk, in this deviation here of the potential curve. So it will be distorted by the field. The bond will be softened. Okay, this is just a little bit commercializing that in the meantime we can do the full time dependent Schrödinger equation solution. We can see or confirm that the TDSE calculation gives this R dependence roughly like this simple modified ADK formula. In absolute numbers, it's very bad off. But in the effect, if you scale it, is at least reasonably represented. Yeah? Here you go outside the tunneling regime, so it's also understandable that this is not so well. In the meantime, we can do much better, much more accurate, much more detailed. Every point here is a full TDSE calculation of H2, full dimensional. We can do it without a supercomputer, I should say. But this is somehow not the most relevant thing. I just say, okay, we confirmed that there is this R dependence. That's the key message. Now, can we use it for something? If you have a very pronounced R-dependent ion yield, and if you have now a fast ionization process, a fast pump pulse, a very short pump pulse, then we should deplete the large internuclear separation component of the wave function, phase function in the beginning, and we will create a wave packet. So you should create not only a wave packet in the H2 plus ion, but also in the remaining neutral H2 molecule. Now, I could not convince the experimentalists who finally measured it successfully, even in the end, to believe that really. Yeah? Of course, if you tell that's quantum mechanics, everyone agrees. if you consider what it means in the experiment, that you have a superposition of your neutral molecule and the same molecule being in the ionic state plus an electron which is driven away by the very strong laser field, really of far distances. Yeah, and you keep this coherence as long as you don't measure. Yeah, it's, as I said, for many experimental colleagues it was not really acceptable. Yeah, but okay, that's what I would think should be the prediction. So as I said, what you can do is the following in very simple cartoon. You eat away this large R component of your wave function, and as a consequence you get a coherent wave packet. And this, as I said, we called Lochbass. Yeah, hole eating by an animal, violent hole eating. It's a purely quantum mechanical effect, evidently. It's a superposition state of the ionized and the neutral molecule. And I will come to this later. That's important. From our simulation, we found immediately it's absolutely non-resonant because you ionize. It's not like stimulated Raman or so. You go close by to another state. You really ionize. Yeah, you tunnel ionize, and the electron is driven away by the laser field. Yes?
This wave packet that you create.
Yes?
I mean, it is created. I mean, what you are saying is that you ionize first the large distance part of the wave function, right? This is what you say.
And yes. So,
but this exists only for a very short time.
Yes, you have to be fast.
As time's going on, you ionize the rest of the wave function to the short distance. So this wave.
If you have a very short pulse, not. That's exactly the point. What you need is a very short pulse where you do not have subsequent ionizations all the time.
So what would be then the order of magnitude typically related to the vibration time on H2?
Okay, in H2 it would be 8 femtoseconds. In D2, where it was finally measured, it was 11 femtoseconds. So you need basically one, two cycle pulse.
Right.
Exactly. So where the maximum, at least, where you have sufficient ionization intensity, has to be one or two maximal at most. But I will come to this in more detail. Okay. So as I said, it's absolutely non-resonant, and it's highly non-linear, which means that now you have created the wave packet moving in the H2 neutral ground state back and forth. Its ionization probability will of course change whether the wave packet is on the inner side, lower ionization probability, or on the outer side, higher. Yes?
About the non-resonance, does it matter?
I will come to that. Good question. Yes, it matters. I think it matters a lot, actually. This makes it interesting for us afterwards, even after some years.
Can you comment on the time scale for the ionization to happen compared to the time scale for the wave packet to move?
In simple tunneling models, going back, of course, especially to Corcum, to Paul Corcum, it's much less than a quarter of the cycle where the ionization happens. It's really close to the maximum, but then it depends on the intensity. So as higher the intensity, as smaller gets the window where most of the, practically all of the ionization happens. I mean, if you have your something like this, not very symmetric, but you know what I mean. Yeah. The idea is that the maxima only here, around here and here, ionization can happen. Yeah. Because it's so highly exponential suppressed if the intensity goes down. Of course, there will be some ionization here, but it will be orders of magnitude lower than here. But now how much this dominates over the other part depends exactly on the intensity. And if you go to the other extreme, high frequency, low intensity, of course, finally it will be the envelope which is counting for the ionization. Then you are in the multiphoton picture. Okay.
And can you just translate that to femtoseconds?
Yeah. As I said, in H2, it's about 8 femtoseconds is the thing. And in the 800 nanometer laser pulse, this fourth cycle duration is 2.6 femtoseconds. And the ionization will happen in sub femtosecond timescale. Okay. Good. In H2, you will have a rather simple vibrational wave packet according to the simulations. It should have been, it was the prediction at the time, the fastest vibrational motion to be observed in real time because it's faster than in H2+. And it should be an extremely long-lived wave packet because the vibration excitation requires two photon transitions. So it's a kind of molecular clock or quantum pendulum. And for other systems, it should even have, I mean, if there's any clear nuclear geometry dependence of the difference between the electronic ground state potential surface and the one of the ion, you will have this effect and you will drive different types of maybe even coupled vibrations. Okay? This was a simulation. This is the internuclear separation as a function of time. So you eat away in the different cycles something, and then you have your vibrational wave packet going on. If you do it for different 8 femtosecond delay, 8 femtoseconds, 12 femtosecond delay, 12 femtoseconds, and you measure the ion yield, you will get a very similar structure, but different height, amplitude of the interference pattern. Now finally, as I said, otherwise I would probably have trouble to tell it still, the experimentalists in the Joachim Ulrich group in Heidelberg in the Max Planck Institute measured these oscillations. And they were exactly fulfilling the correct oscillation period of, at that time, D2, which was 11 femtoseconds. Yeah? So it was confirmed. Now, they raised the question because they were really upset about this effect of Lochfass and this neutral molecule ion superposition. So they asked seriously, is it really the Lochfass? Or maybe, is it this bond softening effect, this variation of the bond? Yeah? And they like this more because this they found much more understandable than this. Yeah? To think about it. Okay. Interestingly, we sit together, and with the simulations we found out it's possible to distinguish the two by the absolute phase, because they could measure the thing actually finally over hundreds, actually over thousands of periods. This oscillation, we could extrapolate back to the absolute phase for zero delay, the virtual one, and we could distinguish the two. So really, it was found out that from this simulation, it is very much dominantly Lochfass with a small contribution of bond softening. So you have to take both into account to get the full matching of the curves. Yeah? So this is dashed is a pure bond softening chain, is a pure Lochfass. Solid is a simulation of both effects, and circuits is the experimental found period.
How can you distinguish in the simulation between all those things? Because I suspect that in the simulation you just put everything, right?
No. It's really a model simulation where we solve a nuclear time dependent Schrödinger equation with either only the real part of the potential change or the imaginary part or both. So it's an optical potential approach. It's not a full TSE including nuclear motion and whatever, everything. This has not been done yet. Okay, I will, for time reasons, not discuss ammonia, maybe somebody is interested and you can ask, but I just want to come to the distillation effect. So it was later on found also in iodine by Gibson, but they even made another nice observation of this effect, because they figured out that if they have, because iodine they cannot cool down like in H2, they don't start with the vibrational ground state, if they start with a more thermal distribution, higher thermal distribution, they get more coherent wave packet in the end. So you really get more coherence by starting with less coherence in the initial state. And this was also for them very surprising. I mean, they published it, and they also the simulation based on our model, and they found it confirmed rather well by their experiment. But there was not a real good explanation why is it possible that you can get more coherence with less coherence in the initial state. Of course, there's a very simple argument why. With higher vibrational states, you populate more on the outside, so you're more sensitive to this effect, but this already points to a number of questions. Namely, why did Lochfass work at all in this experiment? Because the experimentalists did not have carrier envelope stabilized pulses. So the phase from pulse to pulse was different. They have a short pulse, so they have a large spectral width. So the wavelength is a wavelength distribution. So you should initiate your stuff with every pulse differently, or with every part of the pulse. Then you have a variation of the pulse lengths from shot to shot. They are not that perfect in these high intensities. So why did they get such a nice signal? Why could we distinguish Loch pass and bond softening by the absolute phase, the starting phase at artificial time delay zero? Why, as Gibson pointed out, you have more incoherent, with more incoherent initial state, you get a more coherent wave packet in the end. I mean, finally, it means you start with different vibrational states. I mean, they have a different phase. They are not linked. It's thermal distribution. Yeah? Why can they all add up or pile up to the same signal? And I mean, I should emphasize from the outset, and this was actually what we argued in the beginning, the simulations show this. Yeah, according to the simulations, you have all these effects in. But that, of course, doesn't tell you why it happens, really. So we tried now to analyze it more carefully recently. So why is it so robust? If you look in detail how what happens for different carrier envelope phases, or for different wavelengths, assuming always a tunneling model, however, here. Yeah? I mean, this is not 600 nanometer you can discuss. But just to give you its large differences in the wavelengths. And of course, you see a completely different onset of your effect. But the magic is whatever happens afterwards, the wave packet you have created always looks the same. The only this difference is the amplitude, which of course you can tune with intensities. Yeah?
Does that mean that at some point this effect would depend like on a single parameter? I mean, whatever you do in this zone, so something like a quantum defect ID or something?
We didn't find really this convincing, a good argument in this direction. So what we really analyzed is, and made as a difference,
it can't be independent of the laser wavelength over too many. But if you go far enough, it can't be.
No, as I said, this is artificial, assuming tunneling model to be working independently whether it's true or not. This is just for modeling, for understanding this result. Of course, in experiment, at some point you will have to stop. Yeah, definitely. But this is just to make the point that the simulation all predicted all these effects, so it should be in the simulation already. This was the argument. And so what is really the main point? The main point in original process and looking on the electrons, how they behave in the laser field, you have the laser field idealized as an oscillating thing, where you have maxima in both in a linear polarized laser field pointing in both directions. So one's up or one's down. So what you have, you create a wave packet coherently, which you drive. Ionization occurs at the maxima. The electrons fly, in fact, left or right, or up or down, depending on your detector. So you really get Rabi-type physics, as you're used to. But now, what happens here for the nuclei? The nuclei see something mediated from the electrons. So actually, if you consider both bond softening or Loch Fras, what you will see is that there will be something happening on one side, but nothing, so to speak, on the other side. Because you should, of course, not forget this is not a good thing because it's a radial part. So what you actually see is, with bond softening, you see it even more clearly. Yeah? The potential curve is going down and to the standard neutral position, down to the neutral position. But it does not go up, down, up, down. And so this seems to be the main difference between the processes. So you have the nuclear motion, it's field dependent, mediated by the electron, depletion at phase maxima, but always depletion, no sign, no left-right dependence. So what you have actually is a kind of periodic one-way kicking. And if you now do a very simple two-state model, of course, this you can criticize definitely, but from the principles, at least it gives the same direction. We take a model pulse sequence, this is a zero line, of square well pulses. But now in the Rabi type concept, up, down, plus, minus, plus, minus, plus, minus. And we contrast this to the situation where we go from zero up, so one-way kicking. Then we assume a two-level system, saying, okay, we know that at least here we should get some Rabi-type physics. What do we get here? The nice thing is then we can solve this whole problem analytically. And this is the outcome numerically then. I mean, just plotted the outcome. If you now take a sine pulse duration, the whole thing, the envelope, to be 300 arbitrary units, and you now cut it in 1 cycle, 3 cycle, 10 cycle, 30 cycle, 100 sub-cycles, yeah, so envelope is 300, then you have a sub-pulses of this size, what you see is, as you would expect for Rabi type physics, the thing cancels out. So in the beginning, if you have 1 cycle, you get some nice oscillation. With 3 cycles, which are not commensurate, you will get some strange behavior. But then if you go to the limits of already at 10, you get only this. With 30, you barely don't see it. With 100, it's practically the zero line. So you get, this is a population of the excited state starting from the other state. So you practically do not get anything because the whole thing, so to speak, is destructively interfering. However, if you do the same thing now with the one-way pulses, then you get a very different picture. You get the one subcycle, the three subcycle, but then the key point is that with n equal 10, it's a green one, I hope it's partly visible, with n equal 30, it gets this, with n equal 100, it gets this. So what you see here is, there's a slight offset of the maximum, but it's very minute, but it stabilizes to one Rabi oscillation, so to speak, which is independent of the subcycle frequencies. Now that's a key point. I mean, we are speaking here of the frequency of your laser, yeah, not the envelope. So if you have more and more cycles, it really converges to a 50% population in this two-state model, yeah, of the excited state, but it stabilizes to one excitation curve.
What is the physical significance of that?
I mean, this is really, I mean, the idea is that what you have is a power pulse with sub-cycle structure. And now the question is, why do you don't see the influence of the, so to speak, details where the sub-cycles are and how many sub-cycles you have? And what you see here is that really changing the number of sub-cycles from a certain point on gives you the same answer, while here, it will give you also the same answer, but zero. Yeah? So no excitation anymore.
So in this plot, you have this nice, simple asymptotic curve. What's the significance of the time scale for the oscillation?
This depends now. Sorry, I have put not the parameters here. Of course, the oscillation then depends on the energy difference between the two states. I mean, we have an analytical formula where there's some correction to it. I mean, it depends on... But it's a kind of Rabi formula. And you see in the other one that it's in the n goes to infinity limit, it goes to zero, and here it stabilizes to finite value. But of course it oscillates still with the sinus. Yeah. For the population of the sine square. Yes. That's basically what I want to say. So just in the outlook I may say, okay, as I said, I mean, one more summary. We think that in principle, this Lofthouse effect allows for the observation of nuclear motion in real time. It has been demonstrated in H2 and iodine. There are now experiments running on ammonia, but not yet have seen something, but the laser broke, etc. The interesting thing compared to other wave packet studies of this kind in strong laser fields is that we really have the nuclear motion of the neutral ground state. I would emphasize this is what actually the people wanted to do when they speak about watching chemical reactions. It's not the ion you want to look normally the reaction of. You want to see it in the neutral ground state. Long observation times are possible. Yeah. Of course, the key point is the time resolution, yeah, the real-time observation. As I thought, if there's a stable vibrational motion, like in D2, in ammonia I left it out. You see even quantum tunneling in principle. And rotational Lofthouse has also been recently predicted by the Korken group. And it's, as I said, the nice feature we think is it's extremely robust concerning all laser parameters. It's therefore surprising. And we think this kicking is the key point, which we would call then a Korean distillation effect. Thank you very much.
quite a few questions, but we have time for one more.
All questions
can
answered.
Can you repose my question? Because it's, okay. I still don't see the difference from doing a Raman transfer and creating a whole.
Because then you are really depending on choosing the proper frequency. That's exactly the point. Then you do Rabi physics, which is nice.
Sure, but the motion on the ground state would be the same. You can also watch it, so it's not.
You can, in principle, watch it, yes, but the time resolution here, due to the laser field, has been much higher. I mean,
if you have a short laser. The time resolution is a nuclear.
But if you do Raman with a very short pulse, then you will have the spectral width and you will not populate just one transition. I mean, either or. No, I mean, the spectral widths of your Raman laser will define how many states you couple. I'm sure of that. And this limits.
Yeah?
If you have a single transition, you have enough bandwidth.
Yes.
You basically do the same. Because what you're showing that your selective imposition, the theory that's used is exactly the same
I know.
Theory. Because you take the difference potential. Mm-hmm. So if you have, let's say, not the bound state on the top. So you get rid of half the wave function upstairs. And it all depends on the bandwidth. And if you have enough bandwidth, you'll get the same effect exactly.
No, but if you have more bandwidth and you have considered the anisotropy of your potential curves, you will not go into the same state down. I mean, of course, on the long run, yes,
no,
I agree to that. I understand.
The point to think
I know.
In which I agree with you, you don't go down, you blast away half the wave function.
Yes.
The way I like to think about it, I have a wave function that's stationary. If I throw away half of it, doesn't matter how, what's going to be left is going to oscillate. This is the effect that you're talking about. Now, this you can do with any impulsive method that's in principle possible. So what you're describing is an impulsive method. And if I would think, how would I think about it? You throw away the kinetic energy of the nuclear motion. So anything, any process that you can throw away the kinetic energy of the nuclear while you're applying your impulsive excitation will create a hole in the ground state, which will vibrate, and you'll see it in a proper experiment.
Yes, I agree. The point here is that you can do it here on a much shorter time scale because you are not bound by the bandwidths, which otherwise would populate many other states, which you would also see. I mean, I agree fully. I mean, and we have cited, of course, the stimulated Raman work in our paper. I mean, we were very well aware that stimulated Raman is another effect, which is giving you the same vibration wave effect, and it has been shown in H2 also. But it has not been used so far on these time scales. And that's the interesting effect here. And as I said, what I think is a funny effect here is that it's, I mean, I know that the language has to be now very carefully chosen because people will also say Raman is, of course, detuned. Yeah, that's true. But we are speaking here of an extreme flexibility in the detuning. You're really far, far, far away. Of course, you can always use the same language and then say, okay, it's a kind of very far Raman transition, very far detuned, far Raman transition. But I think the dissipation here is important.
It's the same thing that I have to get rid of. Okay,
Yes.
Well, thank you very much for listening. Let me go. We should move on to the next one.